This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Onslow County is leading the way in how they generate power for local homes and businesses. The Onslow County Board of Commissioners recently approved a project that would place 6,000 solar panels at the landfill on Meadowview Road. This announcement comes just after a landfill gas-to-energy system was installed at the same site. On Wednesday, the director of Onslow County's Department of Solid Waste, Scott Bost, took me on a tour of the gas-to-energy system and the solar panel test site.
What you're looking at here is an example of a solar panel installation.
It was a cold, windy day at the solar panel test site, the future spot of the 14-acre solar farm. There wasn't any smell, even though we were standing on top of the oldest landfill.
Yeah, three panels, but there'll be 6,000 of these on the site here. The reason this is here, we're to demonstrate to the state that this installation will not harm the cap. We're standing on the cap of the closed landfill.
According to Bost, this is the first solar project in the state to be located on top of a capped landfill. When completed, the panels will produce 1.9 megawatts of power, which is enough to power 2,400 homes.
The reason it's level, because as garbage is degraded over the years, it's subsided to this level surface. As you can see, it's a nice grassy level surface, so it's ideal for a solar panel installation.
However, the solar farm's location on top of a hill does make it susceptible to high winds. But Bost says the panels will be anchored to the ground and can withstand hurricane force winds. Construction will start after the first of the year and should be completed in June. Once the solar panels are installed, electricity will be combined with the output from the nearby landfill gas-to-energy system and then sent to the Duke Energy power grid. So far, Bost says the project has attracted the attention of other municipalities across the state, including New Hanover County and High Point, that want to implement similar systems.
We received two calls from landfills, one in Gaston County, one in the western part of the state, about doing it at their site too, one who we use and what they should do to get it permitted. So again, Onslow County, leading the way, and that's a good feeling.
The project is being funded by Onslow Power Producers, part of Enerdyne Power Systems based in Charlotte. In addition to decreasing the use of fossil fuels, Onslow County will also benefit financially, receiving a license fee of $10,000 for each solar site. Vice Chairperson of the Onslow County Board of Commissioners, Barbara Eichner, is excited about the project.
Local governments only have one source of income, and that's taxation. If we can provide another source of revenue to our county, it lessens the burden of taxation on the citizens, with still maintaining a high level of services provided. So it's a benefit both for environmentally and a revenue source.
The solar project is expected to provide a source of revenue to Onslow County of between $50,000 and $100,000. Just a short drive from the solar panel test site is the newly installed landfill gas-to-energy system. The facility was closer to the open landfill, and the smell of decomposing trash and methane was thick in the air. Bost commented that it was the smell of money. As waste decomposes, methane gas is produced. The gas-to-energy facility collects the ozone-depleting gas from inside the pit, preventing it from being released into the environment. After the collection, the gas is used to fuel a generator, which creates electricity. Jeff Birch is the site manager for Onslow Power Producers. He's in charge of making sure the generator is always working without a hitch.
This runs 24 hours a day. I come out 6 days a week. I come out on Saturdays, check everything. When I'm here, every couple hours I'll go out, check all my meters, I'll check all my equipment, make sure that everything's running the way it's supposed to.
The generator produces the same amount of power as the solar panel project will when they're operational. Birch estimates there's enough methane gas in the three landfills at the Onslow County site to keep the generator running for at least 20 years. For more information on these projects, visit publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. A new partnership in Craven County seeks to put military veterans to work, growing and maintaining a local organic garden. Mac McKee has more.
The mission of the Veterans Employment Base Camp and Organic Garden is to reduce the unemployed and disadvantaged veteran population and provide a pathway to work. Executive Director of the nonprofit group, LaVey Wallace Singleton, says the effort has multiple benefits.
We are trying to increase the quality of life for disabled veterans by providing them exercise, rehabilitation, and horticultural therapy.
Local homeless shelters, the New Bern Employment Office, and veterans organizations such as American Legion and Veteran Service Officers help identify those who may qualify. Veterans accepted into the program are paid minimum wage and hired to plant, maintain, and produce harvest. The Veterans Employment Base Camp and Organic Garden is also seeking volunteers to help at the Henderson Park in New Bern. The garden is currently funded through individuals, group donations, and grant requests. Fundraising events are also helping. The next is planned for January.
It is the Vets Talk About Vets conversation, and we are having veterans organizations come in and talk about the services they provide veterans and the issues that they see facing veterans in the local community. We're asking for a ticket donation of $20. We plan on using those funds to purchase tools and irrigation supplies. We need wheelbarrows, wagons, and any item that a normal gardener would need. No pesticides, though. We are going to be organic.
The Veterans Employment Base Camp and Organic Garden would like to start with 20 veteran gardeners. As time goes on, the organization hopes to hire more veterans.
We're hoping to get about 50 overall, but they'll be working on a rotating shift or something like that, and we'll take all the volunteers we can get.
Singleton says some of the plants they'll grow include lettuce, tomato, bell peppers, eggplant, lemon cucumbers, and specialty crops, including wheatgrass. Produce that is grown in the organic garden will be sold at the site at the New Bern Farmers Market and distributed to local restaurants. Proceeds will be plowed back into the garden. The Employment Base Camp and Organic Garden recently signed a 5-year renewable lease with the City of New Bern for a 1.2-acre plot of land. Construction begins in spring of 2014.
We plan on having two sheds, a hoop house, which is a greenhouse, but it uses indirect heating and cooling. We'd like to have a gazebo. We're hoping to have 30 raised beds, 20 of them, which will be about 4 feet high. So they're going to be kind of high, so they'll be accessible. And 10 that we want to build that are table style, so that wheelchair veterans can access them as well and just wheel under them and do whatever work. We're looking for an ADA compliant, and that's American Disabilities Act compliant walkway, which means that they have to be a certain width. We're going to have 2 cisterns on site for rainwater harvesting and also a trellised walkway.
The Veterans Employment Base Camp and Organic Garden is working with many civic and government organizations such as the Craven County Extension Office, Craven Community College, the New Bern Employment Office, Chamber of Commerce, Cherry Point Single Marine and Sailors Program, Habitat for Humanity, and Religious Community Services. The plan is for the Henderson Park Organic Garden to be completed by the summer of 2014. I'm Mac McKee.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. In my yard, many of the ornamentals out front are planted in large raised berms, and my vegetables, they're planted in boxes built above ground. My blueberries, they're also in a box. Why is it that I have raised beds for the plants I'm growing? And would they be a good idea for your yard? Well, there's a couple reasons to use raised beds. For me, it's because the soil in my yard can stay very wet, particularly after heavy rainfalls. I even have a high water table. Since many plants are extremely sensitive to wet soils, I figured it was safer to just go ahead and put in large berms of soil in the front yard for planting my ornamental trees and shrubs. I was actually lucky because my first year here in the yard was an extremely wet year, maybe the wettest ever, All the ditches on the island were filled with water for months on end, and the few plants that had been put out actually drowned. Plant roots can die in as little as 24 hours in saturated soils. So I saw firsthand what my high water table and poorly drained soils could do, and I quickly modified that before I spent a lot of money on ornamentals. So what is a berm? Well, in my case, it was dump truck loads of topsoil mixed with turkey compost that were dumped where I told them in the front yard and then smoothed into sort of kidney bean-shaped areas, large enough for at least one large tree and some shrubs. I shaped them carefully so that they would spill water along the edge of one to the other, pushing that rainwater towards one edge of the yard, where it could then safely run off. I made sure to taper the edges of the berms so that they gently sloped down to the rest of the yard, making it easier for the tree roots to adjust in the transition. An added benefit of the berms is that I now have a clear distinction between growing beds and lawn area, and I'm even trying to get rid of some of the lawn area between the berms now, making it more of a path since the trees have grown and begun to shade the area. I'm not particularly fond of lawn grasses. Now, I think lawns full of grass are beautiful, and I know you might enjoy yours, but it's just not a personal preference of mine. And as far as vegetable beds go, well, raised beds serve a couple of purposes there. They make a very clear distinction between the grass or weeds or whatever is in the surrounding area and the vegetable bed, keeping weeding down to a minimum. They also give you an area where you can easily enhance the soil with lots of organic matter, a way to feed the vegetables through the soil and create a wonderful space for root growth. Another advantage of raised vegetable beds is that you can sit on the edge of them to do what work there is in the garden rather than standing and bending over. And finally, if you make the beds narrow enough so that you can reach to the middle easily from either side, you'll never have to step on that soil again, so it won't become compacted. Compacted soil is a poor growth area for plants. So what if your area isn't overly wet? Can you still use raised beds? Of course. We have heavy rainfalls all across eastern North Carolina, so even soils that drain fairly well might be wet at some times, and a raised bed might do well. But do be careful with raised beds. The soil does dry out more quickly, and you do have to irrigate during dry periods. I'm always asked what sort of materials to use for a raised bed. Well, that's a personal preference thing. Mine, for the vegetable garden, are made of newer treated lumber, but there is some leaching of preservation materials from the lumber into the soil and some pickup from the soil into the plant roots. Each person needs to decide what their comfort level is with the potential leachates from whatever material they use to frame their garden bed. There is no one perfect answer. I'm thrilled with my raised vegetable beds and the raised berms in my yard. They've done well for me. If you've had trouble with keeping weeds out of beds or with moisture building up and puddling in areas, think about berms and raised beds. Now that you can see your landscape in the winter with all the leaves off the trees and shrubs, it's a great time to picture changes, and this may be a good one for you. Enjoy a project of raised beds for your yard, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
Today we wrap up our sweet treat series with a delicious holiday recipe for, get ready for this, bourbon pecan pie. The recipe is part of the soon-to-be-published statewide cookbook. Charles Silver, the co-chairman of the Museum of History Cookbook Committee, tells us how to prepare this delectable dessert.
The big thing is to get the liquids and the solids in the right proportion, and that determines the final consistency of the pie. Some people like their pies real soft and smooth, and some people like them a little firmer.
If you want to stick with the authentic Gems Bourbon Pecan Pie, I see a note here that the ideal consistency of the pie should be like a chess pie.
Yes, yes. And that's a little firmer than something like a pumpkin pie or something of that sort. But I think that's a really good consistency for this pie, and it should turn out really, really well.
So the first step in putting this pie together, what do you do first?
Well, the big thing first is to get the liquids warm. So you would want to put your butter and brown sugar and Cairo syrup in a pan and melt them, not boil them, but get them warm and soft. Make sure the butter is not browned and the sugar is dissolved. Then you add your eggs, and you want to be careful adding the eggs, because if it's really, really hot, the eggs will scramble. And so you want to keep it cool so that the eggs don't scramble. Then adding the other liquids, vanilla and the bourbon, and getting that nice and smooth, and then putting in the chopped pecans. We always have a big fight. In my family, they're pecans, and in my wife's family, they're pecans.
That debate definitely starts to heat up around the holiday time when you have family visiting, too,
right? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. it's always a big debate. But then the pecans go in, and then all of that goes into the deep dish pie shell. And then you bake it for about 55 minutes or until it's firm. And that's, you want to check it once you get about 45 minutes. You want to check it and be sure that you're getting the consistency that you want.
Problem I've run into before in the past is that the top of the pie, it looks like it's finished, but the inside is not quite there. How do you know for sure that it's cooked all the way through and it's going to turn out good?
Well, my grandmother would have used a broom straw. And inserted it in the center of the pie and pulled it out. And if there was anything stuck to the broom straw, it wasn't done yet. But most people don't want to go pull a straw out of a broom anymore. But you can use a toothpick. And if there's anything, any residue on the toothpick, then you should cook it just a little bit longer.
I understand that this pie recipe has a secret ingredient, right?
Yes, the bourbon. Yep, and some people claim that they don't put bourbon in it, but they actually do. Some people don't put any bourbon in it at all, and it comes out very much like a regular chess pie. But the bourbon actually cooks off as you warm it off. The alcohol cooks off, and the flavor is in there. And it's a real important ingredient because it does change the flavor of the pie significantly. So you want to be sure and have a good, flavorful bourbon that you put in there so that it does change the flavor of the pie and make it really, really rich and flavorful.
As you were sifting through all of the different entries for the statewide cookbook, I know that you were especially looking for those recipes that kind of had a story to go along with it. So mm-hmm. What's the story and the history behind Jim's Bourbon Pecan Pie?
Well, Jim's, pretty sure it's his grandmother, had this recipe, and she passed it down in her family, but Mama Dip at her restaurant over in Chapel Hill has a very, very similar recipe for deep dish bourbon pie. It just shows that they come from very similar places or backgrounds, and this one happened to be a really, really good recipe and easy to make and had the history that it came down from Jim's grandmother. So
now on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being easy and 5 being difficult, how would you rate this recipe?
I'd say it's about a 2. The only difficulty is making sure that you don't boil the liquids when you put them in and you don't get them too hot, and then you want to be careful putting the beaten eggs in it so that they don't scramble. Other than that, it's really, really simple.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today, and have a happy holidays.
Thanks. You do the same, Jared, and I appreciate this.
You can get this recipe for Jim's Bourbon Pecan Pie, as well as the other recipes part of the Sweet Treat series, including Pull Mints and Yule Log, at publicradioeast.org. 'Tis the season for holiday programming on Public Radio East. Starting this weekend, we'll bring you a variety of holiday programs, including many of our listeners' longtime favorites. George Olson tells us more.
I know of at least two Nutcracker performances in eastern North Carolina so far this holiday season, and I'm sure there has been and will be more. If you caught one of those, make sure you catch Journey Through the Nutcracker Sunday at noon. It's an opportunity to go behind the scenes of Tchaikovsky's masterpiece with the conductor of the Boston Ballet's Nutcracker performance, Jonathan McPhee, as well as members of the cast. It's a great opportunity to see the Nutcracker from the other side of the curtain. People started asking me about one longtime favorite well before the holidays. I'm talking about the Halloween holiday. I can't recall a time when Public Radio East didn't air a Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols. We're not breaking the streak this year. Michael Barone will host this live music and spoken word broadcast from the chapel of King's College in Cambridge, England. The 30-voice King's College Choir performs the legendary Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols service of biblical readings and music. It's tempting not to say when it will air because those listeners who've already inquired probably know the airtime without my prompting, but for those who'd like to join this holiday tradition, be with us Christmas Eve morning at 10 a.m.
It was the very thing he liked, to edge his way along the crowded paths of life, warning all human sympathy to keep its distance.
The holidays are often as much about remembrance as they are celebration, so Christmas Eve will remember a master comedian we lost in 2013. Jonathan Winters passed away in April. We'll hear his distinctive reading of the Charles Dickens holiday classic A Christmas Carol, hosted by Susan Stamberg. Jonathan Winters and Mimi Kennedy will be reading from a special performing edition prepared by Dickens for his own presentations. Jonathan Winters, A Christmas Carol, Christmas Eve afternoon at 3 o'clock. We mentioned multiple local Nutcracker performances earlier. The same is true of George Frideric Handel's The Messiah. If you can't make one of those, hear The Complete Messiah on Christmas Eve at 7 p.m. It comes to you from the Washington National Cathedral and regularly attracts an audience some 6,000 strong. Join them, as well as a cast of the finest national and international soloists, Christmas Eve at 7 o'clock for The Complete Messiah. 2013 marked the 100th anniversary of the birth of the renowned British composer Benjamin Britten. His music is enjoyed on Public Radio East throughout the year with favorites such as his Simple Symphony and The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra, but it's perhaps at Christmas time that his music shines brightest with works like his Ceremony of Carols. We'll remember the life of Benjamin Britten and hear his music for the season during a centennial Ceremony of Carols, a Benjamin Britten holiday celebration, Christmas Day at 1 o'clock. We'll close out our holiday programming with another traditional favorite. The Vienna Philharmonic has performed a New Year's Day salute to the waltz since the late 1930s. For the most part, it has been held on an annual basis since those war years. On New Year's Day 2014, the orchestra will be led by Daniel Barenboim. They not only honor this annual tradition, but recognize the conductor's 25 years of musical collaboration with the orchestra. It's New Year's Day from Vienna 2014 at 11 a.m. And that's just a few of the holiday offerings we'll have for you over the holiday period. Other returning past favorites include the St. Olaf Christmas Festival, Welcome Christmas featuring the Minneapolis-based chorus Vocal Lessons, and Christmas with the Morehouse and Spelman Glee Clubs. Plus, there's holiday music sprinkled throughout our classical music presentations, as well as on the News and Ideas Network's The Sound. And I would be remiss if I didn't note that every Sunday evening in December, it's 5 hours of the best Christmas jazz during an evening with Tom the Jazz Man. This is all just a bit of how we're celebrating the holidays here at Public Radio East. If you'd like to find out more about our holiday lineup, visit publicradioeast.org. I'm George Olson. A Merry Christmas.
And from all of us here at Public Radio East, have a happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and a prosperous new year. We leave you now with the sounds of the Craven Messiah Chorus, their performance from 2012.